If I'm not brainstorming, I'm filming. If I'm not filming, I'm editing. If I'm not editing, I'm waiting on feedback. So there had to be a mental shift. Even if you're doing this for fun, there are people who are making a living off of this. It's a business.
Annie Popola, through Any Given Sunday, she represents a new generation redefining ambition. Because her story isn't really about becoming a creator. It's about becoming free.
So I graduated law school in May, took the bar exam at the end of July, and didn't start my job until October. And then I get called into this meeting and my partner's like, you're doing brand deals and content creation, you have to stop. And my immediate thought was, oh, this is it. I have to quit. The amount that I had contracted in deals already exceeded my yearly salary.
Wow.
Multiple six figures in brand deals. And the side hustle is starting to look like the main hustle, and the main hustle is looking like side hustle money.
The real question I have is, do you think Black women are being paid what they're worth as creators?
Absolutely not.
On this episode of the Afropolitan Podcast, we sit with creator, lawyer, and multi-hyphenate builder, Annie Popola, to talk about reinvention, ownership, and the quiet revolution happening in how this generation defines success.
And in the chase for virality, what do you think you may have lost sight of?
I think chasing virality makes you lose authenticity. Because...
quick one. Before we jump into the Afropolitan Podcast, I have a problem. So my issue is that 72% of you are not subscribed to the Afropolitan Podcast. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Now we can jump back to it. Annie, so someone's going to click into your specific video and they may be winding down from a long day, drinking a glass of wine. Maybe they're on their way to work, or even they may be working out. Most people that watch our podcast, they're working out. So the first question I have for you is, I want you to tell people, what is the biggest misconception about being an influencer that most people don't realize?
That it's easy. That it is easy.
Yes.
I think people think it is easy work, and we see it all the time, or I see it all the time, when people are like, oh, I tried to get into it and I realized how hard it was and I couldn't, or I couldn't maintain a level of consistency. It feels easy when you love it.
Yeah.
And it looks easy when you're good at it.
Okay.
That's the whole point. When you're good at something, it's going to look effortless. It's going to look like it's easy. And then people get into it and they're like, oh, I'm not actually cut out for this, or I can't actually balance this with the other things that I have going on. And it was funny because someone was in my DMs and they were like, how are you churning out all this content? Like, are you filming all the time? It's like, are you filming and editing all the time? And I'm like, yes, I actually am. Like, all I do all day, every day is film and edit. I'll be in a car editing. I'll be thinking about ideas. If I'm not brainstorming, I'm filming. If I'm not filming, I'm editing. If I'm not editing, I'm waiting on feedback. And, you know, so there's always something in the process, or I'm gaining inspiration from other places. I'm consuming content to gain inspiration. So I think the biggest misconception is that it's easy and effortless work.
What's the hardest part for you, though? Because it looks effortless. You know, people see you Any Given Sunday, but there's probably parts in time where you're like, I'm over this. Like, I'm done with it.
Yeah, I think the hardest part is finding a separation or delineation from content and life. And I was just talking to my therapist yesterday about getting back and finding some things that, like, I do just for me. Because I was talking, I was like, yeah, I want to, you know, have some electives. Like, you know, like in high school, you had the sports or you had the arts or you had something. And I was like, I want to do some electives, whether I get back into a writing class or an acting class or learning how to swim and all that type of stuff. And I was thinking about it and I was like, in every circumstance, all of those things can be turned into content. And I have to stay committed to not doing that, to finding something that is just for me. And one of the things that I do just for me most of the time when the weather is good in New York is just going on walks. Like, I never have my camera out or post my walks, especially because of safety. I'm like, I don't want to post my walking route. And that's the one thing that I do just for me. But it is very challenging to find the things in my life that I can keep to myself that I don't turn into content, or that don't become things that people are like, ooh, how do you do this? And tell us more about that and share a little bit about this. I'm like, whoa, I need to find something that is just for me, because otherwise, from sun up to sundown, from eyes open to eyes closed, I'm thinking about work and content in that way.
You know, it's interesting because we've spoken to quite a number of influencers and they talk about this balance of what parts are for me and what parts are to show the world, right? And one of the influencers we spoke to said that she feels like she doesn't, people don't get as close to her as she thinks they could because she doesn't share all parts of her life. So how do you decide, like, to create? I mean, I don't think it's a negative thing to create a parasocial relationship. I think sometimes it can be good, and then there's negatives to it, right? So how do you decide the boundaries of, like, okay, these are parts I'm open to, and these are parts I don't need anyone to know because I don't want anyone to question me about these parts of my life?
That is so funny because I feel the same way, but I feel like I purposely create a circumstance where I'm like, you can't have all of me. Mm. And I, the way I view it, I'm like, I think it's almost like a treasure or a gift for the people who know me personally to get the full part of me, and for the hundreds of thousands of people online to get just a portion, right? Like, it feels so strange to feel like the person who picks up their phone and just gets to scroll gets all of me in the same way that my mom would, or my brothers would, or my close friends would. So I actually like the fact that I create this boundary between how much I share with people online versus in real life. My number one rule is I don't post about what I don't invite commentary on. So if I don't want you, if I don't want you talking crazy about my mom, or if I don't want you saying anything about my brother. I remember one time I posted like something about my little brothers, and I had young girls in my DMs like, "Oh, are you looking for a sister-in-law?" And I was like, "See, what we're not gonna do is this." So I'm very, you know, protective of my family and even my friends too, right? Like, I don't need you making commentary about my friends. And, you know, sometimes by posting or sharing, people can know the details of your friends' lives without them even sharing that online. Like, I remember once I hosted a Galentine's Day, and I have a friend who went into work on Monday, and her coworker was like, "You were at Annie's over the weekend." Oh, and she was like, "Yeah." And I'm just like, see, like, granted it was a low stakes interaction, but if that person wanted to say that they were sick over the weekend, or that, you know, that they couldn't, or for if they wanted to have protection over their schedule and the privacy of their schedule and their life outside of work, they would have lost that by what I would have shared. So I'm very mindful of that. But also, I will say, I am one to not really share things that I'm going through while I'm going through them. So I can, a lot of my story times are looking back on high school and college, because I'm like, okay, I've gone through it. I've had the opportunity to reflect, to parse out what that lesson was, what the purpose of that experience was, and now I can share it. But if I come online and share about something in the middle of it, I'm like, I don't really know that I fully processed it. And sometimes things are also sensitive if they involve other people as well. And I don't really like to tell stories about other people that I know, even if we've had a falling out, even if we're no longer friends, right? I'm like, if you are still someone that, if you held some sort of space in my life, I'm not talking about the customer service person online or the front desk person. Yeah. Like, you know, those are small characters in the scheme of life. But if we had a relationship and we either still know each other or don't talk to each other anymore, I don't want to share those stories either. So I think I am very intentional about the stories that I choose to share and the parts of myself that I choose to share online in that way.
So I actually want to go back real quick, because I feel like obviously a lot of people don't realize with creators, you are creating for a while and then there's something that puts you in the zeitgeist. And that was you transitioning from law to creator, right? Now, my real question I got, right, because I was in HR. Did you know that it was, you were kind of on the line, or did you have no idea that this could happen to you?
I had no idea. And I think at the time, like, you know, I heard the rumblings of what people were saying, which was like, how could she not know? And da, 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 da. And I think people underestimate what the experience is of being first gen in these professional spaces as well. So like, we talk about first gen and graduating high school, first gen in college, but I call myself also like first gen corporate. No one in my family, in my immediate family, had worked a corporate job. And this was also my first corporate job as well, because I was a teacher before law school. So the whole, you know, suits and button up environment, that this was the first time that I was in this environment. I was very mindful of the social media policy. Like, when I came in, I was like, you know, reading that back and forth, blah, 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 blah. But the concept of like not working a second job or not moonlighting, like, that never crossed my mind, because I don't know. I feel like our generation is very side hustle. Like, we have a very strong side hustle culture. So that just definitely didn't cross my mind at all until it did.
And for context for the viewers who might not be familiar with the story. So you were at Columbia Law, and you, at some point, they had you or asked you to choose between
law versus social media, right? And you basically chose to pursue your own passions, right? And that's just for the context for the viewers. The question I had, though, was, I think on Instagram now, and by the way, for context, I also went to law school. And I chose to transition. I didn't take the bar, right? I was like, look, I don't think it's meant for me. I recognize that one early.
Mm-hmm.
But I have Nigerian parents and their expectations of you. And I kept on telling them, like, just give me 2 years and I'll show you that this transition is going to make sense. The reason why I'm bringing this up is I'm on Instagram now and I'm seeing lawyers who are maybe litigation lawyers who are now content creators, right? And I think there's this famous one. I think she's based in maybe Chicago, but she's a litigation lawyer. And every time she's using the hip hop music, I don't know if you've seen her on your Instagram. When you see stuff like that now, do you wonder to yourself, yes, I was early, but could you see yourself managing both now while creating that type of content as well?
Yes and no. Mm. So my feelings around that, I don't think I would have been able to manage both at the level that I'm doing content creation now. Because it's not just the content creation, it's the events, it's the brand trips, it's the speaking engagements, it's all of the different places that I'm like called to be that just wouldn't have allowed me to work a traditional, I call them 9-to-9s because the big law jobs are not 9-to-5s. Like at the minimum, you're working 12 hours a day. And so I don't think I would have been able to work in that environment. Could it have worked out in another environment? Like at some point in time, I thought, you know, I'll do the big law thing, punch my hours in for a couple of years, and then maybe take a less demanding job, a lower paying job that I can afford to take because of the supplemental income from content creation. Now I'm like, I don't think I have the time. I barely have the time to do all of the projects that I want to work on, much less like a whole other job. But also my feelings around that, I'm not going to lie. Initially in the beginning, there was some feeling of resentment around seeing people like able to do the content creation and their job without it being an issue. And initially when I left my job, there were some people that were like, oh, they did you dirty and they would have never done that. And I didn't want to entertain the thought because I was like, that's a little bit too much for me to have to like
navigate,
unpack and think through. But I remember at some point in time, like maybe a year or less than a year after, I had a partner at another big law firm reach out to me because she wanted to do content and she was asking for advice. And I was like, this is so, she was like, you know, like, well, how do you do it? I wanted insight on how you did it. And in my mind, I was like, well, I didn't do it because I couldn't, right? Yeah. Like, because I wasn't given that option. So it's very interesting sometimes seeing people, and a lot of people aren't able to do it because a lot of jobs and firms treat, you know, the policy or have a policy similar to the one that I was under. But sometimes I'm kind of just like, this is very interesting that, you know, this looks different for other people. And I'm not mad at it because I really do think if you want to be able to do everything, you should. But it makes me think about my own situation and how, you know, maybe things might have gone differently if I looked different or if it was not content creation and if it was, you know, a more respectable business or something like that, you know? So I have those thoughts sometimes.
But what did that internal conversation look like? Because I know for me, obviously, law school, your parents, your reputation, how people view you in society. Oh, I'm in law. I'm going to do law. So a lot of the status that comes with that too, even though, I mean, a lot of that's changed now. But that internal conversation, because I do remember where I was actually, I had my Kaplan open about to prepare for the LSAT test. Oh, no, not LSAT, the bar exam. And I got a call from the vice president's team of Nigeria saying, hey, we're coming to San Francisco. And we went out for Paulton to do something. And I was like, I'm so confused. I'm going to law school to be able to be in a position to talk to vice presidents. Why? It's not making sense. I closed the book and I went about my life. And this is where we are today, right? What was that conversation like for you where you're like, look, You like, had there been, what were the examples you had seen that were like, this is actually a viable choice to make and I'm willing to take whatever comes with it? What was that internal conversation like?
Yeah. First of all, I love that. You're like, close the book and what about my life? not even about my day. What about my life? Love that. Love that for all of us who get to do that. Precursor. So before, there was a lot building up to that day, which I still remember. It was March 14th. And I remember it because it was the day after my birthday. So I like literally never forget. I, first of all, never wanted to go into corporate law at all.
Interesting.
Never. And I think had I not gone to law school at the peak of COVID, I might have been presented with more opportunities. But my first year of law school around March, COVID hit. And, you know, you get your automatic curriculum for your entire first year, and maybe your first year spring is when you probably get to explore. You throw in an elective, and then over the summer you might, you know,
intern,
and then your second year there might be an externship and in-person clinics and all that type of stuff that you get to really have fun. And my entire second year was virtual, and then third year was not virtual, but socially, like, you still weren't going into court. There are people who graduated law school in my class who may have never stepped into a courtroom the entire 3 years because COVID impacted the way we could show up in person. And so that made it very easy to just go with the flow and do all of the things that they say you're supposed to do. Oh, you're going to go into big law, and then you're going to do you're going to take evidence, and you're going to do judicial federal court clerks, whatever, all you're that
triggering
type of
me
stuff.
Right here,
no, literally, you're going to do all that type of stuff. So I did all that type of stuff. It was the path of least resistance. And I feel like had I been in person and had I paid attention, I would have put, it takes a lot to do something different in law school, but I felt already I wanted to be on a more entrepreneurial path. So maybe I would have pursued a little bit more of that IP stuff, the entertainment law, that sort of thing. But that option wasn't really that present. And it would be a little bit harder to push back when you're just talking to people through screens and you're just getting, you know, those informational interviews. So I never really wanted to go into big law, but hey, these are the cards that were dealt. But I remember feeling unhappy and feeling a little restless. And I was having a conversation with my best friend from law school. And it was inspired by the fact that we had a classmate who was clerking in, I want to say, like, Mississippi. He was clerking in Mississippi, and he was able to be like an adjunct professor at like a college level for the local university or the local college. And I was like, that is so cool. And we graduated the same class year, and you're doing something that, like, I kind of would want to do. Like, I was a teacher. I still love education. I still love to teach. And I'm like, if you ask someone if that were possible, like, who worked in the law school career office, they would probably tell you no, that you need to do this first and this first and this and da 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 before you end up getting that role. And I was like, but that's not the case. And so I remember asking her and saying, like, yo, how long are we going to wait until we get to do the things that we actually do? Like, how long are you going to give yourself to actually be like, oh, I'm doing what I actually want to do? Because it doesn't make sense. They told us, okay, 4 years of college, push, and then you got to do 2 years for a gap year, and then you got to do 3 years of law school, but then you got to do 2 to 3 years of big law before maybe you go in-house before. And I'm just like, it's just going to be a series of telling me all the things that I have to do before I actually get to have fun and enjoy what I want to do. And I was like, enough is enough. Like, we've been doing this whole back to back, like, okay, wait, well, you got to put in time here, and then you got to pay your dues here, and so I was just like, I thought I was going to stay here for 3 years. It's looking like 2. And I thought I was going to be here for 2 years. It's looking like 1.5. And now I'm looking like maybe I should get out of here at 1 year. And that was the conversation that we had, I want to say January, February. And then I get called into this meeting, and my partner is like, you're doing brand deals and content creation. You have to stop. And my immediate thought was, oh, this is it. Like, I have to quit. Like, this is my opportunity to leave. Because I was just talking about, like, how, and I was like, I was saying a year, and now I'm like, a year turned into 5 months. So the decision was immediate for me because I had this, you know, feeling of restlessness in the background. I was also getting a little paranoid. My content creation was impacting the way I was making, like, building relationships in the office, because I'm like, even if I don't talk about content in the office, which I didn't, I wouldn't film in the office, I wouldn't talk about it, it wasn't my fun fact, I never brought it up. People, the way the algorithm works, people can pull up their phone and just see and be like, oh, wow, like, this girl is whatever. And I remember one day specifically, I was a part of the Sephora squad, and as a part of the Sephora squad, I was on a billboard in Times Square. No, literally. And I'm thinking,
that's awkward.
No, I'm thinking, well, this is an office full of people who live in New York. So, like, no one's going to be in Times Square. No one's going to see it, until one day in February, someone comes to me and she's like, I think I saw your face on a billboard in Times Square. And I was like, oh, like,
that's my twin sister.
Oh, no, literally, I was like, oh, interesting. So things were building up to a point where it was like, this is going to be really hard for you to hide. And it's I know how people are, and I know they're going to be like, oh, she thinks she can do that. She thinks she can, you know, parade around here and have all this fun on the weekends when this job is supposed to be taking up all of your time. So all of that was happening in the background leading up to that meeting. And so when she's like, you have to stop, I was like, I have to quit. Like, I have to leave, because yeah. this is the one thing that makes me get through the day. Mm-hmm. I'm like, ooh, this job, I don't really love it, but at least I get to go home and work on content. And it was also something that I had been building for years. I worked on it all through law school. And so people are like, you spent so much time in law school working on, and I'm like, I also spent a lot of time working on content. And I also was like dragging my little brother to do photo shoots across the city. And I was editing and I was writing blog posts. Like, I was treating that as a job as well. So I invested just as much in content creation, not monetarily, because law school is expensive, but I invested just as much in content creation as I did in law school as well.
No, it's so funny you say that, because it's 3 years of law school. So first year I'm in CIF Pro. I said, I don't think this is for me. I ain't going to hold y'all. Like, I think they went through some rule 12B
procedure. No, literally. I'm like, all this jurisdiction.
This is where I check out. But then the rest of the year, the rest of the 3 years, I could now pursue entrepreneurial pursuits. So I'm in constitutional law mm-hmm. taking calls about business. And I'm like, I have to step out. But those 3 years gave me the foundation to now build a business. Whereas if I'd been in or just focusing on law school itself, I might not have had that time. Yeah. Right. Were they shocked when you were like, I choose to quit? Because I think most of them come into those meetings like, ain't no way you won't cut off this other thing and stay here. So what was that reaction like? What did they say?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think they like go into those meetings thinking it's just going to be a little whack-a-mole, yeah, yeah. like a little like put out this little fire and we'll keep it moving. And that wasn't the case. I remember going back to my office and I had an office mate. And he was the only person that I trusted to share. Like, we had spoken about some of the content stuff and he was so intrigued and loved it and was happy for me. And we also went to the same law school. So we like vaguely knew each other beforehand. And I walked in and I was like, I think I have to quit this job. And he was like, no, don't make them push you out. Like, you don't have to quit. But I was like, no, I gotta go. The reaction, I mean, all I will know is the email reaction I got, because I sent an email, but, I remember we were working in office 3 days a week. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday were the days that I chose. But I decided that I wasn't going to come into the office on Thursday. And I knew I wasn't coming on Friday. And so Wednesday, when I left the office, I took all of my things because I was like, I'm not coming back. Yeah. I took all of my, yourself. I took my extra shoes, my flats, like all that stuff, because I was like, I'm not coming back here on Monday. The email that I sent was pretty cordial. And it's funny, I kind of consulted with an employment attorney. I didn't want anything from them. People were like, you could have gotten this. And I was like, no, I want to be able to walk away with my story. Like, I don't want to, if I take something from them, they're going to be parameters around what I can share. And I don't necessarily want that. And I don't need anything from them. So when I consulted with the employment attorney, I was a little bitter and I was like, you say I can't. Do you think it's not compatible with the profession? I think otherwise, but whatever, I quit. Like, that was going to be my approach. And he was like, hey, like, to be very honest with you, you say that you don't think you're going to practice long anyways, right? And I was like, correct. And he was like, I'm going to be honest with you. You don't become a lawyer in 2 or 3 years. Like, you become a lawyer from the decades of practicing, of problems, of experience, which made sense. So he's like, if you're already thinking that you're going to be done with this in 5 years, you might as well leave now. Like, you might as well just get on out of here now. And in that way, you should just thank them for helping you make a decision that you would not have otherwise made, because I wouldn't have quit, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't have resigned. And that was my fear. Like, up until that point, all that I had were natural ends to things. The school year is over. Graduation comes. Yeah. The program is finished. I had never been in a situation where I had to make a decision to leave. And when you enter your first job, when you enter the workplace, you now have to decide when you're out of there and when your time is up. And so they helped me make a decision that I needed to make, but probably wouldn't have made, because I would have been so concerned with what people would have said and how people would have felt and whether it would have made sense. So I just said a thank you. Like, you know, I appreciate this experience, but I think this is the path that I need to go down for me. And the response was, you know, good for you. And I don't know what the conversations looked like after the fact, because I ended up sharing my story on social media.
I shared it as a water cooler.
And it caused a fire. So I know there were meetings. I know the partners were talking. I know there were policies put in place and things like that that were made. And I know now they ask in interviews whether people have social media presence and like having more than 5,000 followers, or don't quote me on that number, but like it is a big thing. And there was a shift definitely that happened afterwards. But for me, the conversation looked pretty cordial and it was just like, all right, wish you all the best.
But from a financial perspective, because for most people who walk away, right, like you're talking about six-figure jobs, the prestige, the restaurants you're used to eating at, all that comes with that. And you now know, like, look, I'm the one who now has to go fend for myself. Because some people love 9-to-5s because of that safety. Had you built up a safety net? What did it look like before you're like, hey, rent is still due the next month, whether you're doing content or not doing content, right? So what did that look like for you?
Yes, I'm actually very grateful that I had the experience of almost being a full-time content creator before I started the job. Mm. The summer between law school, between graduation, so I graduated law school in May, took the bar exam at the end of July. 2 days after the bar exam, moved into my first apartment, like my first apartment on my own, and didn't start my job until October. Mm. And the last loan disbursement is in January. So let's say that was done by May. From May to October, I'm on my own. And especially in that time period where I moved into an apartment. So I'm paying rent, New York rent, security deposit, furnishing an apartment. People go on bar trips. I took myself on a bar trip to Bali. I did all of those things and I was fine. Mm. And I remember I was deciding, like when I had accepted my offer, I was deciding between the September start date and the October one. And I almost chose the September one because I was like, I don't think I can go that long without like money. Like I've never had to just have months where I'm making all of these huge financial decisions and don't have a source of income. Like that's crazy. And I remember talking to my mom and she's like, you will have your whole life to work. Like, take that extra month. You will be fine. And once that October date came around, I was just like, I could go another month. Like, I'm good. Yeah. I don't need to start this job right now because I've traveled, I've moved, and I'm fine. And so that was my first indicator of the fact that like, oh, without any, and that's considering the fact that I didn't need any moving fees from my firm because I partnered with a moving company. Like I didn't need any I took way less money. Like that's the thing, because I left less than a year from the firm, normally you have to return certain things, but I didn't have anything to really pay them back because I didn't take anything from them. I didn't take any loan or anything out in advance. So financially I had that experience of being fine. And then also when I made the decision to leave, I, you know, crunched the numbers and at that point in the year, so it was March, I had contracted in deals. The amount that I had contracted in deals already exceeded my yearly salary.
Wow.
So at that point in the year. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Multiple six figures.
Wow.
By March in brand deals. So I'm like, obviously this would have been nice, but I remember having a conversation with my manager too. And she was like, you know, we're looking at these numbers here and I know if they pay you in big law and the side hustle is starting to look like the main hustle and the main hustle is looking like side hustle money. And I was like, you're right, but we don't have to have this conversation. Like, I'm like, you're right, but I'm still gonna do this job because like whatever, but that is true. And so I always say I would not have made the decision to leave if the numbers weren't what they were at that point in time as well. Mm.
But what did it feel like to get your first proper check from like brand deals, right? What was that transition for you where you're like, look, I was doing this out of the love of the game and then I get the first check. What was that story like?
Yeah, I remember the first like big check that I got because I had started with a trial. Up until that point, I was kind of negotiating my own rates and I was playing it small. Think like $500 here or there. And the reason for that is because it was my hobby. Like I was like, any money is a bonus because I'm not doing this for money at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then a management company reached out to me and it was at the time where I felt like I needed help because I'm like, I can't talk to all these brands at the same time. I'm going to class. Like, I need help. I need someone to just talk to the brands and figure out the execution of these campaigns. And they came in and I had already negotiated a rate with this brand. We hadn't signed anything, but I think like what I had negotiated was maybe like $700 or something like that for something, right? And the management company comes in and they're like, we're going to see like if they can, if we can rework some stuff. And they get back to me and they're like, yeah, okay, so the new agreed upon rate is $7,000. And I was just like,
Lord, Lord.
$700 to $7K.
That money hit right before I went to Ghana in 2021 too. So I was like, oh, like, first of all, I was just like, I'm set. Like, this is one deal. From 700 to 7,000. And it, also in my mind, I was just like, oh, okay, I see the value. If you don't know how to negotiate for yourself, if you don't know how to price yourself, I see the value in a management company. Because I'm like, okay, they take the 20%, but that 20% that they take is in itself larger than what I would have gotten. And the 80% that I'm left with is like multiple times what I would have negotiated to begin with. So yeah, it was just like, oh, wait, this is, I still was in a mindset of this is still nice. Yeah. And now I get to set this aside and save and I don't have to feel like I can't do certain things. So it was nice in that regard. But my eyes were definitely opened. I was like, oh, we're entering a new territory. That was the first one that I remember, but it wasn't until like around March of the year that I graduated law school that it started to feel like they were consistent. And then I signed with the Sephora squad by June of 2022, which is around the time that I graduated law school. And then it was like, oh, this is consistent and this is an income. And I was like, okay, this is serious right now. Yeah.
So, but the real question I have is, do you think Black women are being paid what they're worth as a creators?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Number one, there's so many levels to this. Number one, it is easy to say that there is representation when the representation is the same faces over and over again. And I'm speaking from a place of privilege and I now have an awareness of like, oh, like when I go to these events or when I see who's on these campaigns, it's me, it's, you know, people that you know and that you recognize. And so it might feel like, oh, we're getting paid our rate and oh, they have Black women represented. But there are countless times where I go into events and there are people like white people that I have never seen before and may never see again because you're pulling from like hundreds of white creators when the pool for us is just way smaller. And it's smaller for a number of different reasons, whether the algorithm is not kind to us, whether our different approaches to our content is not accepted by everyone because we are really diverse. Black creators are diverse and not everyone loves the way that like one person might talk versus another. So I don't think we're getting paid what we're worth in that regard because it can be the same faces over and over again, the same. And I don't want to say token, because I don't think we are tokens, but I think we become the go-tos. We become the repeat pulls, like, oh, we love her. And there's nothing wrong with being a favorite. But like, is it coming at the expense of new faces coming in as well? And I love creators. Jackie particularly does this. Well, she'll constantly like be mindful of new faces in the space and following them and uplifting them. And it's a lesson for anyone who's been in this space for a long time to think about that as well. Like, what does it look like to platform other Black women creators who, you know, are still growing? And in this day and age, it's way harder to grow. I don't think we're paid as well because, again, as I mentioned, the algorithm is unkind to us. And so it's a lot harder to hit that million. It's a lot harder to get the millions of followers or to get the engagement, which is what brands might be paying for. I don't want to say Black consumers are a little more skeptical, but like they do their research. That's how I'll put it, right? So if a brand is looking for conversion, right? Like, you may not be dealing with an audience of people who will buy at the first sign or at the first sight of you saying, go buy this product, right? It might take, all right, my favorite influencer said it. And then I saw on a billboard and then I saw more reviews on it. And then I saw this other person use it. And then I was like, okay, let me go buy it. And that may not come across in the conversion statistics of that one creator. And so brands might be like, well, I don't think our community is actually really buying the product, because they're not just like, let me just throw my money anywhere. And I think it's important to be smart with your money.
Yeah.
But I think it also makes it challenging to say, like, no, people are actually like being influenced here to buy your product. You just can't necessarily connect it to me because they didn't do it until a month after they saw the ad that I put out. And so I think that is also something that brands might be like, well, her engagement, or like they didn't see it, or things like that. So there are a whole bunch of different factors. But yeah, I don't think we're getting paid, because we also drive culture, right? Like, there should be this like cultural tax of like, you know, you're just by virtue of the fact that you are co-signing this, that you are saying that this is worth time and energy, that I think is worth something. Completely separate from how much do you charge for a video or how much do you charge for usage. Like, there's this cultural element as well that isn't acknowledged. The credit that goes to a community, right? Like, I'm thinking this week of a large brand coming out with an edge control, and it's like, right? Like,
yep, I saw that.
And it's like, you know, like, are we? Where did you get that from?
Yep, literally.
You know,
literally.
So it's like there's just a piece of the pie or the conversation that's just, are you even giving credit to a community of people who constantly put content out regarding these things, but you're just now coming in and pulling people who can be like, oh my God, I'm like, Andrew and Dwayne, like, what is it? What do we do with this?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there are a number of different factors that contribute, but all still point in the direction of the fact that we're not getting paid.
Yeah. And I think another thing I've noticed also with creating is, I think the challenge is there's not enough influencer managers that are us, right? Because funny enough, whenever I see a campaign and I see a bunch of Black women being uplifted, I go to LinkedIn. I'm like, yep, because there's a Black woman. Mm-hmm. They're behind making sure we're actually part of the campaigns too. So I think there needs to be more of us also in the system to make sure that we're actually getting paid.
No, I agree. And it almost reminds me of like when I was a teacher, or maybe, I don't know if it was when I was a teacher or when I was in law school, but it's like, it's not just about having representation in students, yeah. Right? Like, it's about having it in professors, yeah. And having it in the tutors, and having it, you know, like, you want the representation to be all around. And I feel like that's kind of similar, where it's like, it's not just about having the content creators, a diverse pool of content creators. It's like, it's also the influencer marketers, and it's also the VPs of brand marketing, and it's, yep, also the CEO or CMOs that, you know, like, it's the whole entire thing that should reflect the consumer base and not just the influencers themselves. So yeah. I think that's really important.
I think that the nuanced question I have is, I've been in situations, and we've both been in situations, where as Black people, we go into rooms and there's this sense that they're used to not dealing with Black people who are as educated, right? And so when it then comes time to start negotiating deals and talking through things, they're like, oh, well, we're used to being able to take advantage of it. So what did that look like for you, especially with your legal background, right? And going into these rooms, and they usually tend to think that some influencers are airheads, right? So, mm-hmm, we can just easily take advantage of you and you won't know, which is why the same brand that has the budget for $700 knew that it had a larger budget, right? So what did that look like for you, you know, observing those situations?
Yeah, a huge part of the shift, one, had to do with me viewing this not just as a hobby anymore, right? So there had to be a mental shift of like, well, even if you're doing this for fun, there are people who are making a living off of this. And like,
It's a business,
right? Like, and I had to shift to, oh, okay, like, so they're booking me, but in the past they would have booked a model, a studio, a videographer, an editor, a producer, the caterers. Like, they would have booked all of this to do a shoot, and now they're just booking me. So instead of thinking like, oh, this is too much for one TikTok video, I'm thinking, oh, wait a second. I am the producer, the editor, the creative director, the all of the above.
Yeah.
All of the above. The legal, you know, like, yeah. I am that person. One, a huge part of it had to do with a mindset shift of like, oh, this is not just for fun. This is a business. The second part of it had to do with just getting representation, and paying attention to what they looked out for. Because it's one thing to have a legal background, but a lot of people don't realize that it's the legal expertise combined with the industry expertise. So I, as someone who was going to law school, they're not talking about how much people are charging for an Instagram reel. They're not talking about how much people are charging for exclusivity. So it's going to someone with industry knowledge that says, like, all right, we've seen the big picture. We know what the entertainment industry looks like, and we know what specifically the influencer entertainment industry looks like, or what it looks like for social media, to say, after all of these like repeat experiences, someone with around this, you know, engagement, with around this follower count, should charge this much. And so it really had to look like a little bit of outsourcing to get a sense of what does it look like for someone in my position to charge for a speaking engagement, a post, a podcast, a, you know, like, what does that look like? So it wouldn't have happened just on my own. But what I will say, where the intelligence and intellect comes in, is being able to identify what you want from an interaction or from a collaboration with a brand, and how much you are willing to speak up for your creative liberties, or for, you know, when you're deciding between, is this something that I want to go back and forth on, or do I want to mainly focus on preserving a relationship that might be beneficial down the line? And so now I've gotten a lot better at asking questions up front, and not just being like, ooh, there's money on the table, like, let me say yes, and being like, well, will I be able to have this because it's important to my creative process? Will I be able to speak to this? Will there be able to be other products in the video? Because it's not really authentic to just have the same brand or the same product for every single thing. That's not how I operate. That's not how consumers operate. So I think it is very helpful to be able to have a level of awareness, of intelligence, because again, it's a business. You're managing a business, and a business requires strategy. It requires communication. It requires discernment, all of the above, in order to be successful. Yeah.
So you've also talked about immigrant guilt, right? Mm-hmm. Can you break that down for our audience as to what you mean by that and how that's also affected your own life?
I think, and this is probably especially around the time, thankfully I have a mother who is super, super supportive, but you know, you think about being the first in your family to do certain things, and you're like, ah, I can't, you know, I can't deviate, or I can't, you know, I'm the first lawyer in the Americas in my family or whatever. But I always think about the fact that the point of the sacrifices is so that, like, the next generation can do what they want to do, right? Like, I always say, my mother did what she had to do so that I can do what I want to do. And I get to do what I want to do, but there are certain things that I also have to do so that the next generation can do whatever it is that they want to do. And that's been my mindset, and it's been really helpful, because I'm just like, what is the point of, you know, working these jobs if we're just like, I'm doing it just to be beholden to the job, or just to be beholden to the title? It doesn't necessarily make sense. And so it's like, do what you got to do until you can do what you want to do. And the goal is to always be able to do what you want to do.
What are examples that you saw, whether it's like other creators or maybe just other sorts of inspiration? Was there a book you read that gave you the sort of framework to approach it, where you're like, look, like I said, I did not feel any type of way about leaving the law school. I'm like, yes, the school fees have been paid, but I already know that this is not what I want to do, right? So, but I did not necessarily suffer from that guilt, because I come from a family of multiple lawyers. Like, everyone's a lawyer over there, you know? So for me, I was like, well, you're going to have other lawyers. You don't need one extra one, right? But what did it feel like for you to develop the framework to advance from that?
Yeah, one, coaching. I got a like life coach in the time after, within the year after I left, or maybe it was at the year mark, because I realized I went the full year without talking to anyone. I wasn't in therapy at the time that I left my job, and I had been while I was in law school because of COVID and George Floyd and all that stuff. I was like, I need to talk to somebody because it's crazy. But I finished law school, wasn't in therapy. All of that ensued, and I didn't really talk to anyone. Didn't process, didn't grieve. I remember when I got back into therapy after, she was like, did you grieve that? And I got emotional, because I was like, I didn't really think of it as something to grieve. And I'm like, yeah, that was like something that I worked really hard for. And even if it didn't end up being what I thought it would turn out to be, and even if I didn't love it as much as I thought I would, the way that I parted ways with it felt like it was just kind of taken from me as well. And so I got a coach, one, also to unlearn a lot of the toxic parts of corporate culture. So, you know, in big law and a lot of, you know, big consulting or banking jobs, when someone messages you, you respond immediately. You drop everything. When someone wants something, you put everything down and you put them first. And I remember feeling so overwhelmed by that feeling of constantly like seeing my phone and seeing this brand wants this revision and this brand wants this and this brand needs a concept, and feeling like I have to do everything that they want me to do right now. When in reality, it's like, I'm in charge. Like, this is my business and I'm partnering with you. I'm not working for you. Yeah. And so I had to get into coaching to kind of figure out that transition and figure out the whole, like, I don't need to be working on the weekends and I don't need to be explaining to you why I can't do something if it doesn't work for me, as long as it's respectful and within reason. So there was a lot that I had to unlearn from corporate, and it wasn't just corporate. It's like the Harvard and the Columbia Law Review. And you've been in a lot of the, and then just being Nigerian and constantly deferring to authority and deferring to elders. Like, I had been a student my whole life, and now all of a sudden I'm in charge of my life, and, you know, and it didn't feel like it because I had been so accustomed to, when you say you want something from me, I do it. When I need something, I ask for permission. When, you know, if you tell me no, then it's no, end of story. So coaching was helpful. Therapy was helpful. There's a book by, I believe his name is Stalzoff, called The Good Enough Job. He actually also recently came out with a second book about uncertainty. I have it. I haven't read it yet, but I'm excited about that as well. That just made me realize, like, a job is such a small part of my identity. Like, and a job doesn't have to be something that I'm like incredibly passionate about, because it can just be the means to the end. Like, it can be the thing. We live in a world where we have to make money, and because of that, there has to be a means for us to make money. And it doesn't mean that the means in which I make money has to be the thing that gives me purpose in life. It can be the thing that gives me money and I can find purpose in other things, right? Like, you can have a job and maybe you feel like your purpose is educating people or caring for children or traveling or storytelling. Like, you know, like, it doesn't have to be, yeah, my purpose in life is to litigate the injustices against X, Y, and Z. Like, it doesn't have to look like what we often assume purpose looks like, which is a job. And so, yeah, reading books, coaching, therapy, all of the above really helped me rethink that framework.
So one of the things me and Chica talk about is, you know, the whole DEI backlash now, the whole anti-woke movement, and how when you trace it back to the whole George Floyd time, there was this whole outpouring of support for Black folks, and it feels like that was a moment when we should just collect everything, like reparations, everything you guys have been owing us, just collect it in this next 2 weeks, right? But I was saying to her that it feels like during that moment, let's say it lasted for about a year, where it was like, oh, uplift Black people, we didn't build institutions that could now leverage some of those funding. And when I mean institution, I mean like actual organizations, not just like nonprofits, but things that support us. Whenever the tide changes, we're still here, right? What are your thoughts on that? Also, just in general, can you speak to what that George Floyd moment also meant for you too?
Yeah, I think in that Black Square moment, we didn't really have power. And it felt like we did, because we felt there was power and accountability in calling brands and institutions to accountability, but they still had the power to decide whether they would engage with that. And they still had the power to decide what the policy changes would be, whether there would be any, what representation looked like, right? Like, I remember that was also around the time that, like, I feel like the 15% pledge came out, and it's like, they still get to decide whether they want to engage in this. And, you know, that's it, right? And there's so many levels to it. There's the products that are on the shelves, but there's also the employees that you have and the people that you have in your C-suite. And so it felt like there was something happening there, but to me, it really didn't. And I always felt weird about it. Like, I always felt weird about the, like, you didn't post or you haven't spoken about this. Because I'm just like, what it's going to make you feel better. And it's not actually, it's not coming from a genuine place.
Yeah.
And so brands were reacting. That was what they were doing. They were reacting. There was nothing proactive. There was nothing genuine about that. And it's funny because we say brands, but we're talking about people who work at these brands. And it's like, do people care? Yeah. Do they care? Do the total sum of this group of people that works at X, Y, and Z brand, do they as a group care? Or do they care about just the product launch? Or do they care about selling product, which is what people care about, right? Because then I think like the following year, there were a couple of brands who released foundations and it was like two dark shades. And I'm like, what did we just talk about, right? Like, and sometimes also people don't really see it as an issue. We were, you know, it's a time where we're talking about police brutality and violence. Like, people are getting killed. And I'm not saying that it's a wrong thing, because I always say, like, fit in where you can. Yeah. Whatever your cause is, pick it up and work on it. So for some people, that cause was beauty, but like, some people don't care. Like, they're like, we're talking about people dying in the streets and you're talking about whether or not there's foundation shades for you. Like, some people unfortunately don't care. And I think that was also what made it difficult, right? Like, we're like, where do we spend our energy? And I think we even see that now. People are just like, where are we still talking about foundation and makeup? Like, this is consumerism. Get this out of my face. This is capitalism. Get this out of my face. Like, let's talk about something more important. And I think that is the challenge, that brands can fly under the radar, because they'll just say like, okay, let's just wait until like enough people stop caring and then we'll be able to move on. So yeah, I think there is power in accountability, but it's still up to the brands to decide how they want to engage. And that's what's tricky, right? Like, because you call people out, but the real action, I think, comes from when people decide like, we're not messing with this brand anymore, or we're not, you know. Like, I think the most extreme example that we've seen, the most successful example we've seen, is a brand literally going out of business from not being able to bounce back from their shade range being completely abysmal and their darkest shade being a joke. And I think that's where the power lies. And it sounds extreme and it feels harsh, because you're like, that's someone's vision and that's someone's, you know, livelihood. But in reality, that has to be the consequence, right? Like, if you do not think about inclusion, if you do not think about including people in your consumer base, you do not deserve to be an existing business. Like, and that sounds extreme and it sounds harsh, but that's the only way you affect change, because then it has to be through, like, for some people, it has to be through fear, right? Like, I'm afraid my business is going to close if I don't make this change. So I'm going to make this change. Cause it's like, if you don't care about it naturally, we're going to make you care about it, because this is your business and this is your money involved. So yeah.
I love that. And I actually want to go back, cause I love that you use the word grief, right? So I write a lot about a concept called timeline grief, which is mourning the life that you thought you would have. So do you have any moments where you reflect on a life that you thought you would have? Are there parts that you had to let go?
Yeah, it's interesting, because yes, but then also the opposite would be true, where I'm like, oh, I'm living the life that I thought I would have, but I didn't think I would have it in this way. So like, I wanted to live a life where I was traveling and like, where, and speaking and talking to people and doing cool things, and I'm doing that. I just thought that law was always going to be the means. But yeah, there's always the piece of like, you know, seeing peers and they're like working on cases, and I'm like, what would that have looked like? Like, that might have been cool, maybe, or like, I don't know, maybe it could have been cool. There was a part of me that told myself in my head that I would have wanted to try being partner, but that wasn't actually genuine. I don't think I actually cared about it. I think I cared about the title, right? Of being like, I've made partner, and the respect that people give to someone who is partner, who has earned the position of partner. So yeah, but I think I'm at a place where I'm realizing like, oh, I'm a lot younger than I thought I would be at this age. You know, like, I'm like, I'm 31 now. I just turned 31, and I'm just like, this feels a lot younger than what I thought 31 would be when I was 20, 21. But yeah, I think maybe I would have, I don't think it's timeline grief. Like, there's certain things that I haven't done where I'm just like, I don't drive a car in New York. Like, I don't own a home yet, which I don't know that there's grief around that, because owning a home in New York is different. And owning a home as a single woman is also something that I'm like, I need to be prepared for. And owning a home as somebody who's almost never home is also a different experience. So I'm more so coming to terms with, my life looks different than what it might look like for other people. And therefore I shouldn't be comparing myself to other people if I know what I'm doing works best for me at this point in time.
Mm. How does it show up in dating? Do you?
Yeah.
Because, you know, some men sometimes, I know some men who will be like, hey, I'm intimidated from my partner being like on social media, an influencer, a creator. And then there are other men who are just completely fine with it. So what has been your own personal experience?
Not
that it necessarily has to be men focused, but in general.
My personal experience is definitely the pool is smaller for a lot of different reasons, right? Like, okay. I feel like there are a lot of things about me that are just like very extreme. Like, it's like, it's not like she just went to an Ivy League school. She went to Harvard. It's not like she just went to one Ivy League school. She went to two. It's not like she's just, you know, doing whatever. She's a lawyer. It's not like she's got like, you know, 5,000 followers on Instagram. She's got 400,000, you know, like, it's like, it's like, whoa. Hold on. Right. You know, I have an awareness that can be overwhelming for some, and it's not gonna be for every man. Even if, like, I've been in situations also where I'm like, this person is drawn to me, they like me more than they thought they would, because I think they hear all of those things on paper and they think, I'm not even gonna like her because she's gonna be stuck up or whatever. And I'm like, actually pretty chill, and they're just like, dang, like, what? And it still can't work, because it's like, oh, but you, I don't know how to feel about walking into a room and people are like, oh my God, hi, I love your content. Or like, you know, oh, like, I love her, you know her, da 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 da. Like, it's a lot. It can be a lot. And then also in the way that I show up in conversations, that I might sound smart or, you know, be able to pick apart their argument unintentionally. It's just what I went to school for 3 years to do. And so for me, I'm fine with that, because in the times that I've tried to force it and been like, no, like, a problem, I promise it won't be an issue. Like, in the times where I'm just like, it's only an issue if you make it be an issue, because it's not an issue for me, it has still been an issue. The income piece as well. Mm. And I always say, like, I don't want a man who makes more than me or who makes just as much as me so that he can, like, take care of me. Like, that's not what I want. If he does, great, fantastic. I just don't want to be resented, right? Like, I don't want my life to be full of bad vibes because this person is like
full of bad vibes,
you know, because this person is like, I can't keep up with her, or I'm not able to give her things that she can give her. I'm like, I just don't want that, right? Yeah. Take care of me, sure, fine, fantastic, but you just can't be grumbling here because you think I'm doing better than you and you resent that, and therefore you take it out on me. Yeah. So that's the main reason. And as a result, like, because, you know, I might want to date Black men, I might want to date someone within a certain age range or whatever, it looks like the pool is a little bit smaller.
It's tiny.
Yeah. And listen, man, we leave it up to God's plan at that point, because what can I do? But I live a very full life. I'm very happy. And yeah, but it's tough, especially with the whole influencer thing. Like, that's another thing that can throw people off, because it's almost like being a fake mini celeb. I'm not a celebrity by any means, and I say that, but it's all, some of the experiences that I have are not normal. Like, I'll be talking to my friends and they'll be like, yeah, it's not a normal thing to walk into a room and people like know who you are off rip. Like, that's not the normal person's experience. You're not a celebrity, but you're also no longer existing in this place of like,
your personality. Yes. Now. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's not anonymity. It's not like these experiences aren't normal. You've had interactions with celebrities. You're in these spaces. You're in suites. You're in boxes. You're in first class. That's not the average person's experience anymore. Yeah. And that's what a man coming into the picture is like observing and seeing, like, okay, this girl is flying all the time and the brands are taking her into business class and they're taking her to suites and they're giving her front row tickets at concerts and she's shaking hands with so-and-so. Like, oh, okay. Like, where do I fit in? And I don't think it's my job to make someone feel more comfortable than, like, I don't have to over compensate by being like, no, I promise. Okay. You have to come in and be confident. And there are a select few people who can be okay with that.
How does therapy help with that?
Before we get there.
Yeah.
Cause I think there's important to say, right? Cause I know there's going to be a lot of young women watching this, and I'll say this personally, I don't think women should marry before 30.
Mm.
I don't. I think your brain is still forming. The person you were in your 25, 26, 27 is still calculating. And it's funny because I wish at my times when I was creating content, this was like 2010, 2011. I was with a long-term ex now, mm-hmm. obviously.
So hopefully.
No. And listen, I always say I have no exes and no exes have me. So
exactly right. And he stopped me from creating content.
Mm.
He did. I could have easily been an OG if I had where I was going. And he would just be like, why are you posting on Instagram? And like, that's so grotesque. And did it like, and I, so I got so self-aware and I slowed down being a content creator because of that. And I remember after I broke up with him, I vowed I would never allow that. Mm. So I'm actually glad that I met my husband in Nigeria, because by the time he met me, I was here. I was very public. People knew me. And I was like, I'm going to walk in the room and I want to see how you move.
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel a little off that people know me and are recognizing me, it's going to be a problem. So keep living your life. You are 31. How did I feel?
Finish the story. You can't leave it. No, because you're complimenting me. Finish the story. Like, finish the story. Don't just give them small. Like, come on, just come finish on. The story. How did it feel?
You know, it's so funny because I was telling a friend this literally like 2 days ago. So what was actually very sexy for me with him was he was like, this is nice. For the first time, people are not approaching me. Like, people are approaching my babe. You know what I'm saying? And it's nice to see, like, people are coming up to her and they're excited about her. And he's like, it's nice, you know? And that's what I knew it would work, you know? Because I didn't want anyone to feel like I had to dim my light. I didn't want anyone to be intimidated by me. I didn't want anyone to tell me I had to slow down or change the way I dress or how I appear in life, you know? And he needed to be comfortable. And going back to what you said, because my family exposed me to a lot before we met. So I've traveled everywhere. I've seen a lot of things. I've experienced nice life before he entered the picture.
Not much that can impress me, you know?
Exactly. You can't, so you gotta keep up.
Yeah.
So you do your thing, babe.
Thank you. You know, I just wanted you to finish it. Don't be giving half just. No, but the reason it was important, just for context, was I was used to being the person, because I was in San Francisco. I built a whole community.
Yeah, big party, night, festival, everything, right? Yeah.
And I was used to walking into rooms in California and people would know, or Eche or whatever, whatever. And in my dating life, it would always be the women who'd be get intimidated by that. I'm like, first of all, I don't even understand why you're being intimidated by that in the first place. But it would then turn into the side comments, like, you're too fast, you're too loose, everybody knows you. And then it's creating friction. So when I met her and I'm coming into Lagos and people are like, I was so happy. I was like, oh, wow. So this is what it feels like. Because you never know what it feels like from the other person's perspective. And for me, it was like, oh, no, I'm actually fine. In fact, continue.
Because
I get to now take a break, because sometimes when you're the person that's getting all of that energy, you're like, yo, I need a place to like relax. So when she was doing, I'm like, oh, I'm completely fine with this. Like, I tell her all the time, keep shining, blind these niggas. You feel me? Like, do what you gotta do.
I love that.
And it's just what it is, you know? But I wanted to talk about the therapy angle of it, right? Because I think that's even played a part for us, which is your emotional intelligence grows, your discernment grows, your ability to read energy grows as well. How has therapy helped you even in navigating all the success that comes with this?
Yeah. Number one, I always say, or I now say, that as long as I'm a public figure, I should be in therapy. People are like, there's nothing wrong. Like, why are you in therapy? And I'm just like, again, it is not a normal experience to open your phone and see multiple opinions about your life from people you have never met and will never meet. So as long as you are in the public eye, there should be someone that you talk to help you navigate that beyond your family or friend, people who just won't understand that. So that's a huge part of the reason why I'm like, I'm committed to just staying in that, because navigating being a public figure takes a certain type of resource.
A certain resource.
I feel like therapy, number one, has helped me, again, as we spoke about earlier, about realizing that I, you know, that this is my business and I'm not working for people. I'm working with people, that I have agency. Therapy made me realize that I wasn't really good at paying attention to my feelings. And I think that might come with growing up in a Nigerian household where it's like, what are you feeling? Like, what?
That's
like, it's like, what do you mean?
What do you mean? You know, or like the feelings of people that you observe certain feelings, which is like, you know, when your parents are angry, you know, when they're disappointed, but like, when you do well, there's not really excitement, or there's not really pride, or there's, you know, it's just like really distorted. And so you know, I came to a place where I'm like, I'm nice things are happening, but I'm not really excited about them. Or like, I'm not really thinking that it means much, or I'm not really paying attention to when I'm frustrated, I'm holding those feelings in. And so then I'm not having conversations with people about it. So really just baseline level of like, what are you feeling? And what does that mean for what you need, was really helpful. And that obviously can work in work relationships, right? Like, I'm feeling a little overwhelmed by the number of campaigns that I have going on. I think that means I need to take a step back from the things that I say yes to, or from the events that I go, you know, like just paying attention to that cause and effect, and paying attention to how my body reacts or how my body feels when I'm anxious or when I'm overwhelmed or when I'm frustrated or when I'm happy. Which sounds very elementary, but sometimes that's what we need, because we just go through life just doing every single day is like on autopilot. Like, I gotta do this. People are asking this of me. They're demanding this of me. They're demanding my time, my energy, my thoughts. And I'm just going, going, going. And it's like, whoa, well, how do I feel? And I think that's been the biggest benefit of being in therapy and talking to someone.
What would you say you had to unlearn about money, right? And your relationship with money, because especially like you said, coming up in first gen, I'm the first to do this, first to do that, first to do this. You might not have had a lot of the frameworks, you now know and have access to.
Yeah.
So what were some of the things you had to unlearn about money, even the anxiety that comes with having or not having? Yeah. Right? So what did that look like for you?
I had to unlearn a scarcity mindset. Mm-hmm. Had to unlearn a scarcity mindset. And I feel like being generous has brought more money into my life. So parting ways with money for good reason, because I feel like more will come to, because I'm not like, this has to stay in my hand. This has to stay in my pocket. I can't. It has, like, the energy around that has allowed for more money to come into my life. And even from a business perspective, like before, it might be like, oh, I'm not going to spend money on this camera. This camera has thousands of dollars. And then I'm just like, well, when I spent money on that camera, my quality of my content improved. The more brand deals are coming, the growth in the audience is present. Like, it's a clear link between, you know, instead of just viewing it. Yeah. Instead of viewing it as just, I'm just spending money that, you know, frivolously or whatever. It's like, I can determine when something is an investment, but also I just generally feel like there's more where that came from, and I don't have to hoard, right? Like, when something has run its course, it's even the way in which I treat certain things that might have been like, oh, this is my nice perfume, or these are my nice clothes. I'm like, if I have bought it, if I work for it, I'm going to wear the nice pants. I'm going to wear the quality pants because they are meant to withstand time. Like, I'm going to use things for their intended purpose. And if I can't use it for an intended purpose, then I shouldn't have it. And that's another conversation. But like, if I spend the money on it, there's no like, this is for the nice day. And this is, it's like, there's more where that came from. And when you act that way and when you treat it as such, there truly is more where that came from. Yeah.
So what would you say is your honest take on the current state of America today?
Scary times, scary times. My honest take is that if there is one cause that I would devote my life to, it would be the literacy crisis.
Literacy.
Truly, truly. Obviously, I'm formerly a teacher, and obviously I was the bookworm as a kid. But I really do think people cannot comprehend
what's happening. Yeah. Yeah.
People cannot comprehend. And when people can't also just on a baseline level, when they can't comprehend, you can't have conversations with people. And that's why a lot of times when I share my thoughts, number one, online, even in this digital age of like 15-second videos, 30-second videos, I will post a 5-minute video talking, because I'm like, I want you to understand me, and I do not want to be misconstrued, and I want my ideas to be conveyed exactly as I had them in my head. And I always do a little check of like, can you understand what I'm saying right now? Because before we argue, if you can't understand my point, then we can't have a conversation, because we're not even on that same base. If you understand me and we still disagree, great. Let's have a conversation. Let's disagree. Let's share thought, whatever. But if you can't even engage in the practice of picking out a main idea and knowing what details support the main idea and having that whole framework in your mind, what are we talking about? Yeah. And I think that's what is making it very easy for people to be manipulated, for people to share incorrect information, rage for bait. People to be rage baited, for people to just listen to podcasts with like not critical thought and just be like, you know, propaganda is just running its course throughout. And so I really do think like the literacy crisis is like people cannot read, and they can't, it's not that they can't read like the words on the page, is that they cannot comprehend.
You know, we see this with the comment sections, right? Mm-hmm. Like in terms of just social media comment sections where you're like, you might say something and you know the intention and the comprehension in which it was said. And then somebody else will intervene with, oh, so why don't you like waffles? And you're like, I'm so confused. Like, we're talking about pancakes, right? And it's turned into this whole other thing. And I tell Chica, like, once you realize that, like you said, it's now a waste of time to engage because they've already changed the premise of the conversation. The comprehension is already different. So what are we then gaining going back and forth? Which now makes it even worse because I believe the algorithms then even feed into that, right? So it's like the lack of comprehension because of the literacy problem, you feed algorithms that are meant to maximize the level of rage baiting going on. That's a bad mix.
Yeah, like attacks on what we put in books and what the funding the Department of Education, like it is all very real because when people don't know stuff, when they don't know how to comprehend stuff, you can just do whatever you want and make them believe that what you're doing is good or right or anything like that. Like I really do believe that there would be people, we would have more common ground with people if more people like could understand, like if education were like, and I always say like, especially in America, I'm like, the country is huge. I get it. The experience that I'm having in New York City is vastly different from what someone in the middle of Iowa or Ohio or Montana or Texas or like, we're just living very different lives. And it's very easy to be condescending and be like, you don't know what's good for you, blah, 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 blah. But I'm like, maybe if we did slide people like real, like education and really slide that in there, like maybe that would have an impact in a way that like we don't realize. And so that's what I'll say. Like, I'm really just like the literacy crisis, the literacy crisis, because power is going to do what power does, which is corrupt. And I think if as a people, like if we are educated, that's something that is really powerful in a way that could actually combat that corruption.
Yeah. And I want to go back into the creator economy, right? And I want to go a little bit in the mechanics. I'm first curious, did you make a conscious decision of how you show up as a creator? Like you're like, hey, I'm going to be lifestyle or I'm going to be beauty, or like, do you think about that consistently as you're creating content?
In the beginning, especially when I got on TikTok, yes. So I had been creating on Instagram for a couple of years. That was the thing that I fell into by posting on Sundays my church outfits. And I was like, oh, like this is fun and people would know to look into it. So first of all, that was also an unintentional but intentional decision. But like on Sundays, I'm going to show people what I wore to church that day. Built in consistency, built in cadence, an audience, which really was my following, which were my friends at the time. They know to expect it on Sundays and he's going to post a fire fit, right? So that was the origin. And then that was what I ran with and became Any Given Sunday. And then TikTok comes around and I'm like, I don't want to be dancing on this app. Like, this is not for me. This is a little, you know, another whatever. And the conversation started to shift and it was like, well, brands are starting to pay attention to TikTok. And if you want to, you know, grow and maintain relevance in this space, you should get on TikTok. And so my original plan was, okay, well, I'm not going to post on TikTok, but I'm going to go on TikTok, observe the trends. And there was usually a lead time, like whatever was trending on TikTok would probably trend on Instagram 2-3 weeks later. So like, I'm going to observe the trends and like be one of the first people to do the trend on Instagram so that I would grow my community that way. And then the conversation was like, no, you need to build a following on TikTok. Like, you need to grow on TikTok. And I was like, okay, I'm going to read the room. And I don't think I'm doing anything spectacular in the world of beauty to garner the attention of all these people. Like, this is the era of Meredith Duxbury throwing foundation all over her face and people doing, you know, really attention grabbing makeup looks. And I'm like, that's not really my style. So I can't just come on here and say, hey guys, look at what I have on. Like, you know, I always say like, I can't come on here in a room of none and already act like I'm an influencer. Like I have to, why should people care about what I have to say? And I was at the, why should people care about what I have to say about beauty stage? Like, why should people care about what I have to say about fashion or beauty or anything? And I looked around and I was just like, I don't really see a lot of people talking about law school. And what it looks like to be in law school And I think there are way fewer people who can share that experience online. So that's going to be my vantage point, or that's going to be my entry point. And my entry point was, I'm posting my days in my life as a Columbia law student. I knew it would grab people's attention. I know that the Harvard and Columbia grabs people's attention. I'm not going to pretend I don't know that. And so that was strategy, to talk about my days as a law student at Columbia, to share that experience, and then to weave in my day in the lives, like what beauty products I'm using, or to weave in the beauty angle, like the what makeup products I'm doing for this gala, or what dress I'm wearing to the gala, or what perfume I'm wearing for graduation, right? Like, so now I'm starting to become, one, this person that like is lifestyle, and her lifestyle is law school, but I'm also this person that's sharing my beauty routines, and that's sharing the lifestyle of someone in law school, whether that looks like how I get ready for bed or how I prepare for travel, all of those things. So that was a very intentional decision. And I'm just really grateful that I was able to make the transition from, you know, talking about law or big law and things like that, to just being a beauty, fashion, lifestyle person.
Yeah. And in the chase up for virality, what do you think you may have lost sight of?
I think chasing virality makes you lose authenticity. Because the times, especially early on, that I went viral, I would post voiceovers that almost felt like journal entries. And I would post them as just like a, no one's going to hear this. Like, I don't really have a big following. Like, I'm posting this just because I really like the way that I worded these things, that I worded these thoughts. And I'm just going to post it. Like, that was the thought process. Like, you know, I've been writing blog posts and da, 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 da. So I just really like these thoughts, and I don't have the expectation that anyone is going to see them. And in hindsight, I'm like, these were actually pretty vulnerable thoughts. And these were actually really authentic to the experience that I was having. Like, I remember one video that went viral. I spoke about like fear of public embarrassment or fear of public failure. And I was talking about like, you know, I vowed that I would never again post a relationship online publicly. And I was like, well, is that coming from a place of wanting privacy, or is that coming from a place of, if it doesn't work out, I don't want to be, you know, embarrassed, or I don't want people to think like my relationship didn't work out and that's a failure. And I just talked about reconciling those emotions or those desires. And I'm like, that's pretty vulnerable. Like, that's pretty, you know, that's a pretty, but it was authentic to what I was experiencing at the time. And I think when you're chasing virality, you know, it's easy to go into the like, let me do this dance trend, or let me even talk about a certain topic, because people know that talking about money or talking about relationships or talking, doing crazy story times will get you virality. But it comes, I think, at the expense of just what's natural, like not even just authenticity, but like what is natural to you. And when you build virality based on something that's not natural to you, the community you build is fleeting, because they were never there for something that you were able to maintain.
And I want to, you know, transition to, you know, you've been creating for quite some time, even though you're young. Do you see yourself getting into products? Do you feel like you can be a creator forever? Or do you feel like there'll naturally be some type of transition to something else?
There'll definitely naturally be a transition to something else. I don't know if it is a product. I don't know what it would be. I don't know that it would necessarily be a product. I'm very mindful, and I tell people all the time, I'm like, I don't like products that much.
Really?
Like, I'm like, you know, again, this was a hobby, right? Like, the talking about it, but I'm like, to devote my life to being in the lab, making a lip gloss, or I'm like, I don't like it that much, right? Like, I don't like it that much. So it's far more likely that I would end up like building something like an education platform or a community, something.
That's just a product too, though.
Right? Yeah. No. It is a product, right? Yeah. So I'm thinking like, you know, the beauty products,
like
or
an
the
educational,
fashion,
an educational
product. An educational platform or community or product or something like that would probably be more of my speed. But I also have the realization that careers are long. And when I look at people who even have traditional careers, because I don't want us to frown on traditional careers and say like, ah, like that's so old school. No, like there's a lot to learn from that. And when I look at people in traditional careers, like people are spending 30 years building or getting to a place, right? And I'm just like, yes, okay, the entertainment industry is a little bit more tenuous and you might be here today and gone in 5 years or whatever. But if you do it right, if you play your cards right, like this, there can be longevity here. And I'm pursuing longevity while also, you know, wanting to weave in other things. But this whole rush to blow up and then have five businesses and then do X, Y, and Z, I'm just like, when you look at a traditional career path, people are putting in the work every day for 3 years, 4 years, compounding, 5 years, right? And that is something that I still want to mirror or model about a traditional workspace, right? Like, I'm like, I've been doing this full time now. If I left my job in 2023, 3 years, this makes 3 years.
Wow.
Oh, dang.
You what? Know,
that's kind of short.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah,
I'm just
yeah.
like, I just got here.
Yeah.
And like, there are people who go 10 years before launching their first product because they really nail building the community and yeah. building their voice and showing up. And so I'm kind of just like, yes, I will do those things. And I know I'm capable of doing those things. But also, like, I do have to put in the time to really, like, develop myself in this space. So I'm excited for all the things. I know I'm going to do a lot. Mm-hmm. But I also, I'm just like, I just got here.
Wait, is there a part of, like, creating you want to get more into? Or, like, a side of you you want to show?
I really think I care a lot about, like, production and storytelling. I was actually just yesterday watching a like short film documentary that
Corti?
Yes.
Yeah, Ashake.
And it was so good.
Yeah.
And
yeah, she's
like,
really good.
I was like, this is so good. And what would it look like to like storytell and not even have me at the center of the story? Cause that's the thing. I'm like, yeah, I'm the talent, but also sometimes I'm like, oh, I could be behind the camera too. Cause like that's cool. So yeah, it's time is so limited, but I find that when I post on YouTube in the way that I want, right? Like it's very captivating for a lot of my audience, and that's something that can be exciting. So yeah, something just more with creating long form content, telling stories in that way. Like I thought about it. Sometimes I have the like, what if I just did whatever? Like, what if I just woke up and did whatever? And I'm like, I might just like pick up a microphone and a camera and just go across America talking to people and like just having them tell their stories and see like, what are people actually doing and how are people living like across the country, across even the world? So that's something that's just my like, ah, what if like I just did that? So I think I really do care about storytelling as yeah. well in that regard.
And you have to tell me about, you came to Lagos for Fashion Week for mm-hmm. the first time, right? Mm-hmm. Last year. How was that yeah. experience? How did you feel? Did it feel overwhelming? Cause I know for me, I was like, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
How did you feel?
It felt overwhelming. I definitely came in underprepared because coming from New York Fashion Week, and then I had also gone to Paris Fashion Week with a brand for the first time, these brands can make you feel like you better be happy to be here because you are lucky to be even in the room. So, you know, you better be grateful for whatever crumbs we give you, wherever you sit, the fact that you're even here right now, like just be happy. And it wasn't necessary to carry that just be happy mentality to Lagos because like people are so appreciative. Like there's a stigma against influencers in these traditional Fashion Week spaces. That's like, what are you doing here? What is this person doing here sitting front row? Like you, it's almost like you have to explain yourself more. But when I came to Fashion Week here in Lagos, it was like, no, we know why you're here, right? Like you have given our brands exposure to communities and audiences around the world. And that is meaningful. And especially when you think about the fact that like, you know, in the traditional New York Paris Fashion Week, you show a collection in, say September, and that collection is not available for purchase until February, March.
Yeah.
It's not the case in Lagos. So you show that collection in October, that thing might already be up online, like ready for purchase that same day. And so the impact of a quick post, a quick video sharing the collection is, it's far more impactful. And so the role of an influencer is way more appreciated, I feel, at Lagos Fashion Week. And so for that reason, I was coming in with just like a, oh my God, like they want me here, like so excited. Oh my God, they want to dress me. Da, 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 da. And I'm saying yes to everybody. And I'm like, oh, like I definitely
overdid.
Definitely did a lot, definitely overdid it. But it felt good to be appreciated and to feel like, oh no, you are valued here.
Yeah.
And that's why I say a lot of people should absolutely come out to Lagos Fashion Week, because not only are the designs different from what people are constantly seeing. Like when people are talking about trends, what's trending this season, da, 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 da. I'm like, y'all are not including what's happening in Lagos Fashion Week, Dakar Fashion Week, like any of the, you're not talking about any of that. When you're talking about, oh, everything is boring and the same, you're not talking about was, no, that's not the case here. So it was nice to be appreciated, definitely a little overwhelming at times. So I've taken those lessons and will apply them when I come back this year, because I definitely want to come back this year because it was such a good experience. So good to be here, not in December as well, and be able to meet people and connect with people. So I love that experience overall.
I want to talk about why aunties are so important to African history. Aunties represent curators of the African experience, and oftentimes they have been unacknowledged. They have literally held our archives before they were archives. They were literally institutions before we had institutions. They held so many important cultural artifacts, such as the way we braid our hair, the recipes of our cookings. They represent abundance. There's literally a reason why we call an African culture rich aunties. And we believe that with partnering with Anthony, we're able to showcase this type of history through art. So to connect to African history and get a piece of the Anthony and Afropolitan collection called Auntie, make sure to click the link in the description. And this is your way you can support our channel.
So we're going to transition to a rapid fire segment, which is where we ask you a question. And the first couple of thoughts that come in, you just lay it on us, right? You had mentioned about being a bookworm. Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite books that have shaped who you are?
Ooh, definitely Just Mercy. If I think about Rapid Fire, I will never forget that. Yes. The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace is another one. For some reason, that his story stayed with me. It was a story about a guy who grew up in a rough neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey. Mom scraped together money to send him to private school. He was a really talented person at water polo, ends up going to Yale, but things go awry, and by, I think, 30 years old, he's killed in a robbery gone wrong in his basement. And it was so devastating because it's like we tout these like, he made it to Yale, he did all the things and da-da-da-da-da. And it's like it doesn't just end there. And there really has to be a lifelong commitment to like supporting people through these experiences, especially if you haven't had them young. You know, I've seen a lot of people get to college and get to these elite institutions and it's their first time there and they drown because they don't have the adequate support system for being around people who have an incredible amount of wealth, who can be incredibly condescending sometimes, or it can just be a different experience altogether. So that story stays with me. One, it was also a real life story as well. And just, I don't know, storytelling, that the way that the author wrote that book really stayed with me. Just Mercy as well, because I was just like, dang, this system is crazy. And I, for some reason, had always had not an obsession, but an interest in the like criminal justice system. In the eighth grade, we had to do speeches on different topics, and I chose how I was against the death penalty because I was just like, if you get it wrong for one person, like the whole system is flawed, throw it away. Like, and so reading about Just Mercy and people on death row and that sort of thing was just like, yes, like this is exactly what I'm talking about. So those two books stand out to me. And of course, Bryan Stevenson, incredible work that he's doing in the legal space as well. And so that was also just something that made me feel like, oh, like, you know, I could do this. Of course, Big Law comes in and you're like, oh, what happened? Oh, money. You know, so, but kudos to the people who stay the course and who stick to the cause.
Yeah, I was telling Chica that for all the personal statements you write to go into law school, it's all civil rights. Ooh, this, human rights this.
I was talking about how I want to save the kids from the school to prison pipeline.
Yep. When you get there, you're like, you know what? We're going to go get this check. I mean, we're going to come back for the kids.
Yeah. No,
truly. But I was actually going to bring up that book during the conversation because, you know, Just Mercy was a book. I had never really thought that deep about a death penalty. It's not something that came up as much, but when I was forced to think about it and I read the book, I was like, wow, like you said, if you're getting it wrong for one person, then you have to chill across the board, because it's like, what are we talking about here, right? The other question I was going to ask is, you know, coming back to Nigeria, you're interacting between influencers on this side and the influencers you know what you're used to over there, right? What are some of the differences you're seeing that you're like, this is interesting?
Yeah, I was talking to someone about this yesterday. Influencers here are low-key more akin to celebrities, I feel like, than in the US. Like, if you're an influencer here, like, you have got millions of followers. People are like, oh my gosh, oh my God. Even the little that I experienced at Lagos Fashion Week, I was just like, Someone was trying to explain to me, they're like, no, like if you're an influencer, you're a celebrity. And like, whether you're international or based here, like it is a, you are the celebrities. So that's the hugest difference that I've seen in just how like influencers are treated in society. And it's very fascinating to me. Yeah.
What's your favorite Nigerian food?
Mm-hmm. Abula.
Abula.
Yeah. So amala, owedu, gbegiri, and assorted meats. Yep. extra kwomo, please.
Where's your favorite place here?
Thank you. Usually knock, but yeah. Yesterday I went to Nest and I actually really enjoyed theirs.
That is good.
But a good party like that. My favorite place would just be a good party. Any wedding, invite me and I'm coming to eat. Amala.
Your favorite platform to create for?
Ooh, low key. I don't do it often, but YouTube, I think.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
I could tell.
Yeah. Like when I put a YouTube video together, I'm like, this is so good. Like this feels so good. And I don't think I get that feeling as much on TikTok or Instagram because it just demands like quickness. Okay, we moved on. Next. But the feeling of pride that I get when I view a piece of content, it's usually with a YouTube video.
What's a platform you'll never get on or you just don't care to create content for?
Maybe Twitch.
Okay.
There's a case for it, but I don't think the whole, because the whole concept is like live, like being live, and I'm a boundaries person, right? So I'm not letting you that into my whereabouts and where I am and what I'm doing in this exact moment. So probably not Twitch. Yeah.
Okay. Your favorite brand to wear?
My first thought that came to mind was Christopher John Rogers. Yeah. Who I don't have on today, but I think I have quite the Christopher John Rogers collection at this point.
Mm-hmm. What was your best solo trip?
Ooh, Namibia. Yeah. Namibia.
Really?
I think about that trip all the time.
What was amazing about it?
Number one, it was the most daunting solo trip I've done. So it kind of challenged me. Like I remember once I got there, I was like, what did I just do? Like who sent me? Sometimes I just have hyperfixations on certain countries. And I was like, I'm going to Namibia. And I'm the type of person where if I say I'm going somewhere and I tell people I'm going somewhere, I'm going. So I was just like, I'm booking the flight. I contacted the agency. They made the itinerary. And I'm like, I'm going. And then I get there and I'm like, who sent me to be doing a road trip across this random country that barely has people and you never see anybody for hours, for miles?
Wait, road trip because you're heading to the sea? Or like
no, Namibia is such a vast country that in order to see like more than one or two things, you have to travel through the country. So like there's the desert land and then there's the coast and like they're all of their attractions are really spread out. So I had a tour guide and it was just me and him, you know, and think about it. It's like this girl who has never been to this country has hired a tour guide who's going to be driving her around for like 2 weeks that I spent with this person. And my mom's just like, you're just so trusting. Like, she's just like, what? Like, who would do that? And I always say like, oh, I'm not that bold. I'm not that, you know, and she's like, who would do like, no, you are. Like, do you just think about the fact you just went to Namibia and just like went and did that by yourself? Most beautiful country landscape wise. You would think you're not even on the planet Earth. Mm. The place where the desert touches the ocean, you're like, how is this possible? You literally can see like the layers in the mountains over the years. You're seeing desert adapted animals. You're seeing, you know, that was my first proper safari. So I'm seeing the lions and the giraffes and the elephants and the rhinos and how it was better than TV. But then I also saw a whale for the first time because they have a coast and you can go whale watching on the coast. And of course, Namibians have such a great culture, but there's also a history and sometimes a sad history, the colonial history that they have as well. Exactly. But that country was so beautiful, but it challenged me because at times I was like, did I make the right decision coming out here? Like, it's so quiet. The service is gone. I landed and I have T-Mobile international data. Yeah, and this was the first time ever I landed in a country and they're like, there's no coverage here. Like, and I was like, what did I just get myself into? So that was the best solo trip I've ever been on. But it was also like the most challenging, but most rewarding.
And what's a dream brand you have not worked with yet?
Ooh, dream brands that I have not worked with yet. Maybe Cartier. Mm. You know, I haven't really worked with any like luxury jewelry houses. And I feel like I've spent the past couple of years like building my luxury jewelry collection and really learning about the history of the brand and of those pieces. So yeah, that would be cool, I think. And I say that also because I know that they work with influencers. So I think that would be cool. And that was the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah, I would too. But funny enough, I had a call with an influencer and she was like, sis, they don't pay.
No, I know. No, no. These luxury houses don't pay at all.
Yeah, it's just the prestige.
It's just the prestige and maybe the experience if they take you on a trip and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But yeah, they definitely don't pay. No, I know that.
So the last question I ask every single guest on the Afropolitan podcast is, who do you want to see in that chair and whose story do you think needs to be told?
Ooh.
It could be anyone.
Whose story do I think needs to be told? I'm scrolling through my TikTok For You page mentally.
For You page.
I think I want to know more about Gloria's story. I like know what she has done in this space, but like, I want to hear more about like the story, you know? So I think that's someone who I'm like, yeah, I'd love to hear more about her background. I know she's spoken about being a refugee and that. And I'm kind of just like, yeah, that is a story that I feel like is so... that can be so captivating and so powerful. So yeah, her.
Sorry, Gloria who?
Gloria George.
I know her, babes.
I know, she's but not, I mean the not, audience, the audience, the audience, the audience is
she's
watching.
Not of the world, so he's like,
no, but the audience is watching, so they want to know. So it's like Gloria
yeah,
George.
She's an influencer. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Awesome.
I'm trying to think if there's anyone else.
I know her manager, so I can actually talk to them. But
yeah, no, she's dope. Very, very inspiring. Has done a lot for the space, and I've also noticed some intentional shifts and how she shows up, and it feels good. Like, I'm like, she's made some decisions for herself to prioritize herself. I'm like, I love that. And I can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining
us. Of course. Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
Thank you, Annie.
Of course.